a state of emergency for mental health care here in Florida. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. You can also tune into the audio of this show right now on our Facebook page. And just ahead, why activists are concerned that the state legislative session happening now will end in tragedy when it comes to Florida's mentally ill. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, today's book club, find out what pages we're turning this month. Plus, celebrating 45 years of 89.9 FM on the First Coast. Find out how you can be part of that. All of that ahead. But first this hour, mental health advocates are warning that potential funding cuts being proposed in Tallahassee right now will be devastating for mental health care across Florida. Recent reports are showing a potential cut of $50 million. Florida already ranks last in per capita mental health funding. What does this mean? Well, we're speaking right now with Denise Marzullo, CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us in studio, Jacksonville activist Jonathan Hereford. His brother is in a state hospital after years of struggling with severe mental illness. Good to see you, Jonathan.
Hey, good morning.
And on the line from South Florida, George Malandracht. He's the author of the book Getting Away with Murder, a critical look at his time as a psychotherapist in a state prison psych ward. George, thanks for being on the phone with us.
Good morning. Good to be on.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and questions about how Florida funds mental health care? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Go online to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org to email us, tweet at Melissa and Jax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. And in a moment, George, we'll hear about what you observed during your time in the state prison system. It's all in the pages of your book, Getting Away with Murder. But first, Denise Marzullo, let's begin with you. You've been in Tallahassee lobbying for better mental health funding in Florida. You're really concerned. Other advocates around the state have joined you, saying a potential cut in mental health funding up to $50 million would be devastating. Can you explain why?
Sure. So right now, Florida is at the bottom when it comes to per capita mental health funding. And what that means is that we lack certain services that other states have to treat people who live with a mental illness. So our top states, the top 10 states, spend over $300 per person. The average U.S. state spends $127 per person, and Florida spends only $37. So when we look at that, we're talking about levels of care that we just don't have here in the state of Florida. We don't have short-term residential treatment where people can go and get stable and get funding to continue to support their care and get the services that they need. And so we have a very disconnected system, and it's not because the providers don't provide quality services. They do. We just don't have enough funding to pay for what we need.
Jonathan Hereford of Jacksonville, your family lived this reality in such a tragic way. You've been on this program before. Your brother is now in a state hospital. He had been struggling for many years with severe mental illness. He eventually killed your mom, and you've had to yourself deal with the fallout from this for many years. Can you tell us a little bit more about your family's experience?
Well, Melissa, I could say that was the worst part, losing my mom, but that's not, as it's shown to be true with our state hospital system. It took me a long time to manage my way through the courts to become my brother's legal guardian. I've spent a lot of time in the state hospitals. You would think that people that are committed at that level are getting the highest level of care, and it's just not that way. My brother's been abused. He's worse psychologically than he was before he's accused of committing what he committed. And that's an injustice. And I don't know at what part we start to involve civil rights and human rights into all of this, because he still believes my mom's alive. He's not getting good psychiatric care in the top level of what we have in the state of Florida.
And George Malandracht, that's what your book is about, Getting Away with Murder. It's a story of your time working in a state prison psych ward, a really critical look at what you observed. What were some of the incidents that compelled you to write this book?
Well, that the book came out as a consequence of the murder of Darren Rainey. He was a paranoid schizophrenic patient in my psychiatric ward, and guards had put him into a specially rigged shower and scalded him to death. And I had been fired before this incident for not going along with the program, so to speak. One of my patients was beaten, and I just wouldn't stay silent about it. And so when Darren Rainey was murdered, I started to try to get him justice. And I really found out about how poorly our state handles the mentally ill. And as you said, the funding is in danger of being cut. We weren't fully funded in the first place. And what happens is that people that are severely mentally ill and who often have signs as early as age 14, they're not getting the treatment they need. And so these children and young adults end up being derailed by their mental illness. And if they get involved with the criminal justice system here in Florida, in essence, they're in a revolving door situation of incarceration. They get out, they reoffend as a manifestation of their mental illness. And it's a horrible situation.
That's what happened to your brother, Jonathan.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just something that we're forever changed.
And so, Denise, as we listen to Jonathan's story of his brother and what George says he witnessed working in the system, this is really, it paints a terrifying picture and a tragic picture. What, in your view, should the legislature be doing to address this that they're not doing?
So they're not making mental illness and treatment of people living with a mental illness a priority for our state. Our suicide rates are some of the highest in the country, and that's a direct result of untreated mental illness. The opioid epidemic is skyrocketing, especially in the state of Florida. And all of this is a consequence because people are not getting the treatment that they need. The services just are not available. And our legislators need to make the lives of Floridians who live with a mental illness and their families. Mm-hmm. If you look at how Jonathan has been impacted, you know, because of a family member, we need to make mental illness and funding mental illness a priority. Texas added $274 million to their mental health budget 2 years ago. And we're already lowest. And talking about cutting even more, it just doesn't make sense.
And you spend a whole week in Tallahassee raising the alarm about that. Do you feel that the legislative session will revisit this potential cut now?
So I feel like it went really well in Tallahassee. Fortunately, we had a lot of support, bipartisan support from the House and the Senate. Lots of mental health advocates from across the state all came together. I met with over 25 of our elected officials who serve on appropriations committees, and I think that they are starting to understand what it means. 49th out of 50 states used to just kind of be a statistic to them, and now we're putting a face to that statistic.
All right, let's go to your calls right now. The legislature is in session as we discuss what advocates are calling a state of emergency for mental health funding. In Florida, we are ranked 50th, dead last in per capita funding for those who struggle with mental health issues. And according to eyewitness accounts, patients in the system are tormented, starved, beaten, even killed. We want your calls, 549-2937. Jessica is in San Marco this morning. Hey, Jessica, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. I just wanted to provide a firsthand experience of my mental health, trying to find treatment here in Jacksonville or in Florida. I spent a Labor Day weekend in 2012 in the hospital because I made the mistake of going to the emergency room and told them that I wasn't feeling too good, that I might harm myself. I didn't take anything. I didn't say that I was going to do anything. I was treated like a criminal. I was strip searched. I was brought into a maze of rooms, of hallways that I never would have been able to find my way out of if I had wanted to. They strip searched me. They cavity searched me. Took away all my clothes. My phone would not let me make a phone call to anybody, not even my parents. My parents didn't know where I was for at least a day. They could only come and visit me for an hour. A couple of days after I had been there, I could beg and plead to see a doctor. And in between that time, I was sexually harassed. I had other patients were asking me to trade my medication to them. Luckily, I was in a room by myself, but I couldn't imagine that if I had been in there with somebody, with one of the other patients. It was basically a halfway house for people that were getting off of drugs or alcohol, and I was in there because I was depressed. And after I got out, I felt more like I wanted to harm myself than before I went in.
Wow. Sorry to hear that, Jessica. Thanks for sharing that with us. We'll go to a few more calls in a moment at 549-2937. George Mallingrock, she describes a scenario similar to what you describe in your book, Getting Away with Murder, almost a One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest type situation for people in these facilities.
Yes. Yes. And her experience is very common. And one of the things I want to point out about our mental health budget, too, is that we need to spend the money more intelligently. We're currently spending about a third of our budget on trying to get severely mentally ill men and women who have committed, in some cases, petty crimes, ready for trial. And, you know, this is, we're talking millions and millions of dollars to get about 2,500 people ready for trial, and they're sent to mock courtrooms where they're basically trained like monkeys to do the right thing and say the right thing so they can get convicted. The problem is 70% of these people are given probation or credit for time served, or their charges are dropped. It's a massive waste of money. And we need to spend it on programs of early intervention in our schools and communities so that people like your caller can go and say, hey, I'm depressed, and they're not, in a sense, incarcerated the way she was. They're given appropriate mental health treatment by caring professionals. And there are many caring professionals out there, but this is a very body system that we have in our state, and many, many people are falling through the cracks.
Like your brother, Jonathan.
Yeah, definitely.
If you could go back, if he could have gotten the care he needed early on, what would you have liked to have seen done differently for him?
First and foremost, with a formal diagnosis of severe schizophrenia, just have those implements in place for one, good psychiatric care for schizophrenia. I'm still trying to find a good treatment plan for schizophrenia besides what the state hospital offers.
Because what do they offer?
Well, much like what George said, I mean, right now, the best thing for my brother is he's got to face these charges. It's not about him getting medically or psychiatrically better. So they do a lot of forced drugging, which I got my own thoughts about that. But just like what he said, parroting and monkey information so that you can pass a competency test to come back to stand trial. Where's the care? So when my brother entered the system, he had a mental diagnosis of schizophrenia. But now he's got schizophrenia. He's been abused. And heaven forbid if he starts to come to what he's accused of doing. How do you ask somebody to live like that?
Here's a tweet from a listener. One way or another, JSO's jail should not be the number one mental health provider in town. And it is. And, you know, former Sheriff Rutherford, now current Sheriff Mike Williams, they agree with this. They don't want the jail to be the premier place for the mentally ill to get any kind of treatment. But that's what's happening. Isn't there a local task force, Denise Marzullo, trying to change that? Can you bring us up to date on what's happening with that?
Absolutely. And our Sheriff Williams is really kind of leading a lot of that work, along with Judge Cole and Chief Judge Mahan have really been actively involved. So we're very fortunate in this community because we are very collaborative. And so there's the Criminal Justice Behavioral Health Collaborative, and that's bringing together consumers, family members, the police officers, judges, providers, state attorney, and public defenders all together to really identify what the issues are and how we can best address it. And so we've got to start putting funding. George was absolutely right. We've got to start putting funding in new dollars into more care coordination outpatient services. And once we do that, we won't need as many dollars in the deep end state hospitalization services because we'll be preventing that.
Adam tweets the show, mental health care is vital, but mental illness is still taboo in our society. We need to keep this conversation alive and at the forefront. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking right now about what advocates call a state of emergency when it comes to mental health care and treatment and funding in Florida. Lots of calls. 549-2937. Let's go to Kat. She's on the UNF campus. Hey, Kat.
Hey.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to talk about mental health on college campuses. And so one thing, you know, we talk about it, and we even talk about bringing guns on campus and the disparity between how many students have mental health issues and who are actually able to get the help in a timely manner. One problem that we're facing at UNF right now, and that's not just UNF, it's college campuses and state-funded college campuses all over Florida, is the wait time it can be to get into GET counseling. We've had waits up to 3 weeks, and as a student and as a person who's had friends struggle with mental illness and who's had friends and friends of family members who have passed away from suicide, 3 weeks is just not an acceptable amount of time. And so we talk about it in the city, but it's even affecting college campuses, and we're trying to attract students from all over the state, out of the state, to come here. But, you know, how are we able to support people and support students just from all walks of life if we can't even help them get better in their most desperate time?
So. Yeah. Thanks, Kat. Thanks for sharing that. George, your book deals with the state's prison system, but the state's campuses are dealing with this too.
Yes, that's true. And we are suffering the consequences of not having programs of early intervention. And your other caller mentioned the stigma attached to mental illness. That comes through ignorance. If we can have mental health education for our students starting as early as elementary school, we can explain mental health, mental illness. Students won't have to suffer in silence, which is often the case now. So when these students go untreated, and by the way, we know that 50% of all adults that suffer lifelong mental illness had signs by the age of 14, if we can dislodge the stigma, then we can start to have an open dialogue about mental illness and create parity between mental illness and physical illness. So in other words, schizophrenia, which is manageable, like let's say a cancer, like multiple myeloma, we would be having the same conversation for both diseases.
Mary in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Mary, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. My question was if people with intellectual and developmental disabilities or autism are included in the mental health definition here, and if not, that's a whole other population, you know, running a parallel track with what you're talking with.
Sure, yeah. Thanks for that point, Mary. Denise Marzullo.
Yes, they are. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is what we use to diagnose people who live with a mental illness, included autism spectrum disorders to a greater extent and defined it even more. So yes, we do include autism and autism spectrum disorders when we talk about mental illness, and she's absolutely right as far as the impact of not getting treatment and involvement in the criminal justice systems. And so she's absolutely right about that. And in regards to Kat's conversation, you know, we're finding that our millennials, our college age, are actually so much more accepting than anybody else has been. So that's a real positive that we are starting to head in the right direction. Kat is not unusual, actually, on college campuses to be talking about her own experiences.
549-2937. Ruth is on the line in Jacksonville. Hey, Ruth, good morning to you. Go ahead.
Good morning. Okay. I don't have exactly the same problem that other people have, but I do have a problem which relates to this, and it's serious and it's criminal. I have been, since my husband died 4 years ago, and 4 years ago my daughter-in-law started coming after me. I didn't know who it was. I thought it was strangers that were coming after me. And I eventually was able to identify that she was the one who was coming into my house. And she was the one who was breaking in. And, I mean, the story is so long. It's so hard. I don't want to go into
it. Okay. What's your question, Ruth?
My question is this, is what she was after, I believe, was she was angry with my son or something. And she wanted to make sure that if she was sticking with him, that she was going to get my estate. All right.
Okay.
So she started. She started initiating the Baker Act. She on me.
I see.
She's my daughter-in-law, but she shouldn't be initiating it. But the fact of the matter is, she was she was doing things, and almost all of it was using cybercrime to do it.
So, Ruth, I will say that no family member can Baker Act anybody. It takes a licensed professional
to initiate
a Baker Act. So she could be calling.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Just to clarify.
Ruth, we're going to put you on hold for a minute while we get a little bit more about your story. But this speaks to how widespread these issues are.
Absolutely.
We'll take your number, Ruth, and get more information from you. Let's go to Sharon in Avondale. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Hi. I was calling just to make a comment. I am educated. I have a master's degree in psychology. I have insurance, and I cannot get an appointment with a mental health provider. I am on depression medication brought on by heart attacks, and all I can rely on is my family physician, who is not trained to order or prescribe medication really for mental health illness.
And why can't you get an appointment?
They're booked. There's no one available. There's no one available, period. They're overbooked. You know the state of mental health coverage here in Florida. Y'all have been talking about it. It's horrible, absolutely horrible. And I'm just have depression. I can only imagine the people that have schizophrenia and some of the other bipolar that are in dire straits. And you're right, they end up in the criminal justice system. And
right.
It's extremely sad. So anything that you can do, that you guys can do, bring awareness, and yes, eliminating the stigma would be wonderful. I really applaud you bringing this issue on the air today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sharon. Sorry to hear that. George, so many people end up in the system. I'm sure there were inmates you dealt with. They could have avoided being in prison if they'd gotten care earlier.
That's just so very true. And the point was made that our prison system is a repository for the severely mentally ill. And when we don't get care for people early in life, we end up spending so much money later on. So for every dollar we spend on treatment early, we're saving $5, $10, $15, $20 down the road. The Florida state prison system, like the mental health system, is one of the most cheaply run in the entire United States. And we're currently spending about $20,000, maybe $25,000 per inmate per year. And that dwarfs what it would cost to treat a young child in school. And I once worked for an agency called the Bertha Abbas Children's Center, and I worked with middle school children who had severe psychiatric diagnoses like paranoid schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depressive disorder. When we get to these kids early, we stabilize them. And this is in Dade County, the fourth largest school system in the United States, and in 2008, when we suffered the prime mortgage rate debacle, funding was drastically reduced in the school system, and they fired my agency. There is no longer that program of early intervention, and what I'm advocating for is that type of program statewide. This is the mental health safety net that we need for our children, and if we're not providing that type of funding to get these kids help, we're in essence abandoning our children to mental illness.
For some reason, for whatever reason, Jonathan Hereford, this message that we're being pennywise and pound foolish in how we fund this, it's not getting through to the legislature. What do you think is going on in terms of the politics?
I think there's a lot of confusion. I think we're dealing with the medical community, we got the mental health community, we got the criminal justice community. I think people are scared of big problems. Somebody like me comes along. I served our country I was in the Marines for 16 years. I was on active duty when this horrific incident happened in my family. I've been able to spend a lot of time. I work in the criminal justice system. I've been trying to advocate for my brother to get him some decent help, and I could tell you stories about the roadblocks, and Denise knows quite a bit of my frustration with that, just to get adequate care. I want people to know that they are human beings that have families that absolutely love them and care for them. I've met so many wonderful family members, and their loved ones are lost in this system. And on top of what George was saying earlier, we throw people away, essentially, and then we limit or deny access to families. It's just, it's unconstitutional in my opinion. And, you know, it's beyond frustrating. But I'm always willing to sit down. I have a lot of solutions. If anybody out there is listening, from the Department of Children and Families to the state legislature, anybody, I've got a lot of good points. And I just wish the best, and I'm trying to take care of my brother.
Let's go to Tom on the west side. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to mention, not only is the jail a provider of mental health service, they are a very poor provider of mental health services. When my fiance was incarcerated there, they changed her medication, which was effective, just for their convenience, to medication that was not effective any longer. And it's a large reason why she's my ex-fiance at this point.
Oh, sorry to hear that, Tom. Wow, so many really insightful and moving calls today. Denise Marzullo, where does this issue go from here in terms of this spring legislative session?
So I think we've got to keep contacting our elected officials. We're very fortunate in Duval County that Senator Bean, Senator Gibson are very much on board. We have a lot of freshman legislators on the House side coming from this area who already understand, are already trying to do what they can. So we've got to continue to be vocal, contacting our elected officials, writing them, emailing them, letting them know that this is a big concern. They are listening. They are listening. I think Jonathan was absolutely right. It seems too big to fix. And so instead of trying and working really hard to fix it, I think they're just kind of putting it aside and hoping that there's not a lot of attention. And so we've got to bring that attention.
Well, we appreciate all three of you highlighting it on the show this morning. And we'll continue to follow this. Thanks for joining us. Denise Marzullo of Mental Health America, author George Malenrock on the line from South Florida. His book is called Getting Away with Murder. And Jacksonville activist Jonathan Hereford. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was great to be on. Thanks.
Much more still ahead later, how you can be part of celebrating 45 years on the radio for 89.9. But up next, today's book club. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Should schools be required to offer recess? Does Florida need new fracking regulations? These and other important questions are up for debate in this year's legislative session. WJCT and public radio stations across Florida are teaming up for coverage of hot topics expected to make news. Hear these stories during Morning Edition. Decision Florida coverage all this week here on 89.9 WJCT.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor, Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, the future of Europe. President Trump welcomes German Chancellor Angela Merkel to the White House this week. At stake, a key relationship, and maybe much more.
These guys here, they were scared after Brexit. They're now terrified by Trump.
Is the European Union at a crossroads, or has it reached its destination? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, is it okay to write a story based on a work of Shakespeare? That's the question for today's book club. Here with more, our own Stacey Goldring, book club leader extraordinaire. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well. And we're also so pleased to welcome in studio Dr. Rebecca Jefferson. She's head of the Isser and Ray Price Judaica Library at the Department of Special and Area Collections with the Smathers Libraries at the University of Florida. Thanks for driving over.
Thanks so much, Melissa. It's great to be here.
In a moment, we're going to talk with Dr. Jefferson about book preservation. So here's our question to callers. It's sort of like an Antiques Roadshow question, but it's about books. Do you have a book that you think is worthy of preservation, a really rare or valuable book? If you have a question, just call us up at 549-2937 or send your email to bookclub@wjct.org. More about Dr. Jefferson's important work in a moment. Rare books, just amazing knowledge she has. But first, Stacey Goldring, this month we are talking Shakespeare. Kind of,
in a way, yes. We're talking Ian McEwan, and we are talking Nutshell. And Ian McEwan is a fabulous, fabulous writer. He is from England, and England is proud to call him as one of his own. And what he has done in this most recent book, which is really a novella, it's very short, is he has, I would say, given a Shakespearean overlay to the plot, and he's riffing on Hamlet. So the question is that okay? Is that plagiarism?
Yeah,
that
or yeah, are you plagiarizing Shakespeare?
Right.
What do you think? I guess not.
Well, the answer is, if you're Ian McEwan, you can do anything you want ever.
Okay.
So he has this beautiful ability to write quietly and respectfully and nod to the bard without even you realizing it. So you can read Nutshell and not even know that it is a riff on Hamlet. Or you can read Nutshell and laugh out loud on several occasions because you will see how he has woven in elements from the most famous Shakespearean play. This play has been riffed on by everyone from Gilligan's Island to Star Trek to Star Wars. It's all over the map.
I remember that episode, yeah.
Oh, don't date yourself.
No,
I have no memory. Yeah. But I want you to see that I brought a bottle of my favorite elixir next to gin and tonic, and that is Emmetrol. And the reason why I bought Emmetrol is because we are dealing with a narrator who is a fetus. And when I was pregnant, I depended on Emmetrol to get me through those very early days.
For nausea.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure many of you can relate out there. But
they gave me something called Zofran, just FYI.
Oh, that sounds... Well, I went to Walgreens. You probably went to your doctor. And there
is
the difference
bad.
Between...
Or I wouldn't have, yeah.
Well,
Emmetrol, okay.
Yeah, Emmetrol. Oh, it's great. It is. I highly recommend it. That, like, if I had to have a sponsor, it would end up being Emmetrol or like Pepto Bismol or like Excedrin. But anyhow, so if you are from the Emmetrol company, give me a ring. But no, now let me repeat what I said. Our narrator is a fetus. That is not easy to do.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, you're going to have the Shakespearean overlay, and now you're going to have a narrator as a fetus. And this is so cool because here is the inside of a writer's mind in the nutshell. Brought a nutshell.
She did. She really did. There are physical props here in the studio, which
because
makes this
radio.
Even more interesting. Just picture a nutshell and a bottle of Emmetrol right
there.
Now.
You go.
Okay.
Our author was sitting in a meeting that was being, the language is German, and he speaks German, but not super, super well. So his mind kind of wandered, and this thought came into his brain. This is what happens when you're brilliant. And the thought was, here I am, lying upside down inside of a woman. All right, now let's just couch that. And he's having lunch in Cambridge. I'm not kidding, Dr. Jefferson. He is in Cambridge, or it may have been Oxford. Oh my gosh, don't confuse those two. Sorry. In a very cool British place where you would see a BBC program being filmed. And he's having lunch with his daughter-in-law who is pregnant. And he puts the two together and he thinks, I've got a narrator. So the narrator is like Hamlet, to be or not to be. So the entire book is about whether this our wine expert, BBC World Service loving fetus wants to be born or not, because he's a party to
the fetus likes the BBC.
Yes, because
I'm just trying to follow along here.
Because Gertrude his mom and
listens or watches it.
She listens, okay. And she also listens to podcasts about drinking fine wine. So he knows his Sancerre. I had to look up what that was.
Is she drinking while pregnant?
Oh, yes. So we really don't like her.
Okay.
So we're not too fond of Trudy.
Okay.
But Trudy is a riff on Queen Gertrude.
Oh, I see.
See?
So it's subtle, this book, in terms of the nods to Hamlet, but they're there if you know where to look.
But they're there if you know where to look. Okay. And he is listening to this pillow talk between Trudy and her lover, who happens to be his uncle. Now, think Hamlet. So Trudy and Claude are having an affair. The father is out of the picture, just like in Hamlet. Now, there is a plot for a murder. And the fetus is hearing this. So he is asking, who am I, to be or not to be? Should I even be born? I'm hearing these horrible things. And should I really even be a part of this? And at one point, the fetus thinks maybe I should just take my own life. And only Ian McEwan can make something like this a page-turner and make it funny and make you think, you know, you have to suspend your sense of reality in order to say, yeah, I'm reading a book in the fetus's narrative, because it sounds insane. But in the hands of a great writer, it works.
The most preposterous scenarios become completely
plausible.
Plausible.
Right,
yeah.
Because he's a good writer. So if you are an aspiring writer, do not riff on Shakespeare. But if you are someone like a McEwan, then you bow down in reverence. So this whole idea of this fetus as narrator and wondering who he is, and he's hearing about this murder. His uncle's name is Claude, by the way, and King Claudius in Hamlet. So there's another nod. And while they're plotting this murder, they actually get takeout from a Danish takeaway, an ode to Denmark.
Sure.
And their home is a filthy wreck. Because why? Because something's rotten in the state of Denmark. So you see all these lovely, lovely tie-ins that are just enough for you to laugh if you know. But if you don't know, he's still doing an incredible job of explaining this disgusting, filthy home in which this murder plot takes place. I know, isn't it remarkable? Dr. Jefferson shaking your head. It's a remarkable plot told super, super, super skinny pages, and it's been described as the Brexit of the womb.
It's Ian McEwan's nutshell, Stacy's pick for the first Coast Connect Book Club this month. By the way, the Jacksonville Public Library is our partner in the book club here on the radio. So if you go to the library, just ask for a copy of Nutshell by brilliant author Ian McEwan. This is the one Stacy's recommending this month. Now, you brought a special guest with you today, Dr. Jefferson from University of Florida.
Yes.
You're going to be partnering with her on an event. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, Dr. Jefferson, what you do is so important. You travel the world looking for rare books, ephemera. You know all about handling and conserving rare books and family papers. Why is that so important?
We believe that it's the family papers tell us so much about our history that you know we wouldn't otherwise know. It's accidental history, if you like. It's not the history written down by historians. What family photographs, letters, diaries, documents can tell us can fill in all the gaps that we're missing.
People might have things in their attic right now that are really important. They just don't know.
Exactly right. Please take them out of the attic.
Yes, and take care of them, right, Stacy?
Absolutely. Dr. Jefferson, I've heard her speak about conserving and book preservation, and you have great advice to give to people as they're doing their spring cleaning. If they come across something that they think is valuable, it should not be in the garage. It should not be in the attic. How do you handle something that you think may be important?
Right. First of all, environment is everything. So, garage in Florida, no. Don't do it. Bring it into the house, even if it has to go in a closet. If you're super, super interested in preserving what you have to hand down to future generations, then you're going to want to invest in acid-free papers. You're going to want to make sure that you don't tape down your photographs into books, that sort of thing. There are a number of guidelines, and we can certainly help people understand that more and know more about it.
If they do find photographs, how should they take care of those?
Yeah. So, not every photograph is going to be of huge historic significance. You know, if you have 500 photographs of your bar mitzvah, say.
But that's so important.
It's so important to you. But, a couple of hundred years from now, they are going to start going to be very interesting. So try maybe to sort through them,
and
look
ID
at
them,
ID them,
date them,
and make sure you know you have a representative sample at least that you can hand down.
And you brought a book with you. This looks like an old rare book. What do you have here?
It does. It's one of our wonderful rare books from our collection. It's a book in hiding. If you look at the outside, the binding of it, you can see it says daily prayers in French, and there's a cross on the binding.
And so that binding looks
very old.
Several hundred years old.
This book is from 1778.
Get out.
And if you had that on your bookshelf, you'd probably think it was a Christian prayer book. Well, no, it isn't. It's a Jewish prayer book, a Jewish-Spanish prayer book, and it was owned by crypto-Jews. These were Jews keeping their identity secret from the Inquisition.
Wow, from the Spanish Inquisition.
From the Spanish Inquisition, which lasted through to the 19th century. The last execution was in the early 19th century.
So. And at UF, you maintain a rare book in Judaica collection. Part of it?
It's part of it. We have one of the best collections in the region. And certainly for our rare materials.
What a treasure.
If you are a book lover, taking a trip to this library is amazing. There are so many beautiful special collections. There's a Zora Neale Hurston special collections. Could you explain how you came across her papers? This is a fascinating story.
Not me personally, but our literary manuscripts collection is managed by Flo Turcotte. And one of the collections in there is the Zora Neale Hurston manuscripts. She was towards the end of her life in a nursing home, and no one particularly knew who she was. When she passed away, her materials, her writing, her manuscripts were put into a fire. Because she was very poor, and nobody wanted to take care of her materials. Someone actually did know who she was and actually literally pulled them out of the fire. So we have in our collections her charred handwritten manuscripts of her stories.
What a precious collection that is.
Wonderful.
So many amazing collections. There's a complete fabulous comic book collection. There's a young children's literature collection. This library should be like Field Trip Central because it is so beautiful, and all the rare. There's a biscuit. Explain about the biscuit.
Okay. These are part of our university archives, which are very rich in the history of the university. But one very special item is not a book, it's a biscuit. It was sent home. The food at that time, now you see I've forgotten the date, I believe, probably wrong here, 1940s. But it got sent home by the student who was about to eat it and found it so repulsive that he couldn't eat it. He put a stamp on it and sent it home as an example of University of Florida's bad food. It got preserved by the family and then donated back to us. And we have this biscuit with the stamp on it still today.
Let's go now to Dan in Fernandina Beach. He's got a question for you. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm also a rare book dealer, and I wanted to point out to your listeners that it's not uncommon for someone to think that one book in their collection is valuable or rare, or another one is not. And very often, the layperson is wrong about that, and they will actually be willing to throw out a book or give it away that might be very valuable and be completely wrong on which is valuable and which isn't. It's not always apparent. In fact, most of the time, it probably isn't.
So they need to check. They need to ask someone like Dr. Jefferson, don't they? Or you, Dan.
That's right.
All right. Thanks for the call. Okay. So as we learn about this fascinating topic, Stacy, you and Dr. Jefferson, and by the way, if you're just tuning in, she's head of the Isser and Ray Price Judaica Library Special and Area Collections Department at the library system at UF. What are you teaming up to do?
Well, this fall, Dr. Jefferson, myself, and the San Marco Bookstore are going to have a book lovers roadshow. And what we are
like Antiques Roadshow, like but for books.
Exactly. Won't that be amazing? A whole day. I'm so excited. So we are in the throes of planning this right now. And what people will have an opportunity to do is bring their book to the bookstore in advance so they can take down all the information and take out photographs. And then the books will be appraised. Dr. Jefferson will be there that day to go ahead and also appraise and talk about what's valuable to a museum, what would be valuable to a collection at the University of Florida, what would be valuable as a family member. And this will raise awareness about the importance of not throwing away books. Forget the magic of tidying. Go ahead and hoard. Keep everything until the fall, because we will have an opportunity to share, you know, to share with everyone what is really valuable, and it will educate the community as well. Dr. Jefferson.
Can I just jump in and say, very important that you understand that when we say appraised, though, that we can't say, oh, this is worth so much money. We're not able to do that. We're talking about historical value.
But people need to email us now for more information. Just email us at bookclub@wjct.org to be part of this.
Mm-hmm. And to find out more, you can go to the UF website, and they will tell you information about the NEH grant, that they are looking to raise funds for more opportunities like this to participate and become involved with the library and take advantage of the fabulous, amazing collection.
Wow. It's an incredible discussion. Thank you so much for coming over from Gainesville to share this with our listeners. And again, just email Stacy at bookclub@wjct.org for your feedback on our book club and more about this special book roadshow event. Our leader, Stacy Gullring, here, along with Dr. Rebecca Jefferson from University of Florida. Ladies, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
And in a moment, how you can celebrate 45 years of 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Rukmini Kalamaki, who covers ISIS for the New York Times, talks about being embedded with Iraqi soldiers as they battled to liberate the western half of Mosul from ISIS. We'll talk about the fighting, what life is like for women living under ISIS, and what it's like for Kalamaki to be a woman covering the battle against ISIS. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country, so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
This week on Jazz Night in America, we're celebrating the legacy of Miss Betty Carter.
Thank you for coming.
Vocalist Sharonne Wade and friends pay tribute to the late singer.
It feels a lot more personal with Betty Carter. Really personal, like she's your auntie, sister, friend.
That's this week on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, we're going to go back to the event-filled year of 1972. It was the year of the terrorist attack at the Munich Olympics, the year of Watergate. It was also in 1972 that 89.9 FM first took to the airwaves.
That's right.
Here on the First Coast, we're celebrating our 45th anniversary this year, and we want you to participate by designing a T-shirt that demonstrates your love for public radio. News director Jessica Palumbo is here now with more about our T-shirt contest.
Yeah, Melissa, First Coast Connect listeners remember a couple of years ago we had a similar contest for your theme song.
For the show theme.
And
that's
Pyotr
right.
Chevchik won that contest.
Yes, he did.
So we're looking for the next Pyotr Chevchik in art form. So we're asking you, the listeners, anybody who lives in our listening area, to tell us what WJCT means to you in a T-shirt. We're looking for a winning design that's going to convey the spirit of WJCT. It can interpret what the station means to you, the programs mean to you, or just really what the First Coast community means to you. So it's kind of a very broad guideline.
Yeah.
So submit that T-shirt.
We want creative open ideas. We'll take any good idea.
And the winner of that t-shirt will be produced and given out during our spring pledge drive, which is coming up April 1st through 7th. So the deadline to submit your WJCT 45th anniversary t-shirt design is this Friday at 5.
All right. So people need to get their creative juices flowing. And they get epic bragging rights. That's what they win, I guess. They get to be the brander of our 45th anniversary.
That's right. Yeah. You get some free t-shirts also if you win. And your t-shirt design is given out as the official WJCT anniversary t-shirt for this pledge drive. So it's pretty cool.
Now, we've already gotten some entries, but we really want as many as possible. So how can people submit their entry?
Go to wjct.org/45years. That's 4-5 years. And there's a big entry form right there. You can upload your design and it gives you all the specifications. There's a 3-color limit to the designs. You must include the word WJCT, and you can also include your community, your world. This design must be exclusively created for us for this contest. And that's pretty much it. So just be creative beyond that.
We want your designs and we need them by Friday. So yes. Help us celebrate 45 years of public radio on the First Coast. Submit that design to our website. Jessica Palumbo, our news director, here with more. And I can't wait to see the entries. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. This show's producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board and the show theme. They won the contest. He did. Composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. It's the theme you hear every day. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. Next on 1A, America's relationship with its transatlantic allies is being recalibrated. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.